No, no, you don't.
He's going to introduce himself right now.
Nice to meet you. I'm moderating the panel today. So, by all means, this is reserved for you here. We're going to leave the mic with the two artists because they're going to be heads down probably now and again as I pelt questions.
Leave the mic to two guys who don't deal in words.
Exactly.
You give the mic to two loudmouth guys too. The guy who speaks softly.
Well, I was going to say now that I hear the two of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yourself, I would say give the mic to David.
See, we adapt on the fly here.
I heard him singing in a bar last night, and I was out in the lobby.
Yeah. And you're still up and walking around. That's fantastic. Of course, Bob's saying you're going to do one of your, what was it, Dead Hulk sketches.
Dead Hulk sketches.
Yeah, you're going to do the Dead Hulk sketch for the
auction? Maybe, depends on how much I have to drink.
Load them up, ladies and gentlemen.
From Saturday Night Live.
It's an open bar at the back.
We'll have drinks. Open bar.
Yes. Great. Well, thank you everybody for coming. My name is Blake Bell. I am the author of the upcoming book, Strange and Stranger, The World of Steve Ditko, for Fantagraphics. That will be out in June. With us on this panel today, an illustrious panel, I don't believe we've ever had, certainly if two of the three, if not all of the three gentlemen here at one time, and we're very lucky to have them with us. The gentleman to my immediate right dates well back into the 70s, starting in comics on books like Iron Man. I'm going to make them all feel terrible by the end here. I'm going to introduce my 8-year-old son down here in a moment, too. That's going to make them feel worse. From Iron Man to second only to Stan Lee, if I'm not mistaken, in terms of the amount of issues of Amazing Spider-Man written, to Action Comics, and now back again to Iron Man, would everybody please welcome Dave Michelini.
I got that right there. You pronounced it right, too. Damn. Blake, you ruled, dude.
Thank you very much. To Dave's immediate right is a gentleman who started in fandom, if I may, with a little magazine called CPL. Then came into an association with Charlton Comics in the mid-70s before many successful runs on books like Iron Man, Hercules, and I believe he was one of the leads in a little startup company called Valiant. I think you all might have heard of it.
This guy's definitely a researcher, isn't he?
Great. So he's back as well. With Dave, now on Iron Man, on a couple Iron Man projects. These two gentlemen haven't seen each other face-to-face in 7 years.
Yes, so I came, was in the hospital. Remember, you came to Bob.
Yeah. David! Hey. Bob Layton, ladies and gentlemen. Bob Layton. Please welcome Bob Layton to the show. Thank you very much.
But that sounds like we talk all the time, you know? I mean, we constantly change emails around the phone with each other all the time, especially during football season. So, you know.
But they're big Toronto Argonaut fans. That's why they come up here to see the Argos and the CFL. I watch CFL.
We get
Joe Theismann was up here, and
because I was checking in with Ricky Williams and watching him break his when he broke his wrist or something. You know, and started laughing hysterically. I follow Canadian football to some degree.
Excellent, very good. Well, to Bob's immediate right is a gentleman who's had many successful runs as well on books like Warlords, Green Arrow, and of course his signature character is Sable. Would everybody please welcome Mike Grell?
You left out the great singing voice, though, you know?
We were streaming this to YouTube right now, and for those who came in earlier, of course, you heard their duets on the line, so that'll be selling after the show on iTunes for 99 cents a pop. All proceeds to me, I think.
It's actually the most money I ever make from singing.
So we're here today for what we're referring to as the Men of Iron panel. All individuals here have worked on the Iron Man book or in the process of having books related to Iron Man being released as we head to the May debut of a little movie called Iron Man that I think is going to be a little more than a little. And the first question I wanted to ask all gentlemen while we're here is your first memories of the Jack Kirby Iron Man suit and comic, which will be prominent in the movie as well, the big bulky gray one. What are your first memories?
Anybody? I thought it looked like a garbage can.
A garbage can. Awesome. Yeah,
I wrote something about that in the one of the Marvel trade paperbacks. You know, because to me, it was like that giant lumbering suit was very interesting for me because Stan created something that it wasn't just like an armor designed to protect the guy from bullets or whatever like that. It was actually keeping him alive, and that the negative aspects of wearing this walking iron lung or whatever I was fascinated with. I mean, I was so glad when they made it gold, because so, you know, it's like, yeah, that dull gray, probably, you know, wasn't necessarily great. But I remember with my fascination with knights in armor, I was immediately like, I got it as a kid, you know. And it's like, there's something about that lumbering thing that looked so massive that was kind of cool too.
It reminded me a little of the day the Earth stood still.
Yeah, Gort. Yeah, very, very much. He's very Gort-esque.
Dave, how about yourself?
I didn't start reading Iron Man until I started writing it, so I really wasn't familiar with the Kirby use, the character.
So let's go to the next
one. See, that's why Dave's Iron Man was so good. You see, he wasn't really influenced by that stuff. He understood what had gone before, but wasn't influenced by it. So when he came to Iron Man, that's what I always said to people. One of the reasons why I think he renovated that character was because he...
I didn't know any better.
He didn't know any better, exactly.
So that brings us to, Bob, what you were talking about, everybody's first impressions of the Steve Ditko redesign, the gold armor.
Right.
That happened in the mid-60s.
Right.
And that one has sort of stood the test of time, really, to...
Well, everything is a derivation of that.
Yeah. So what are your first memories of that, Bob?
Of mine? Oh, I thought it was really cool.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, at the time, you know, this was back in, the turn of the last century or something, whenever that came out, I grew up in Indiana, and distribution of Marvel Comics was terrible. Mm. And I never actually got that issue.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like, and next thing I knew, it was like, I pick up an issue of the Avengers or something, and he's in a different armor. I'm like, when did this happen? You know, because Marvel Comics really had spotty distribution around the country for a long time. And I think they ticked off someone in the mafia, and so they weren't getting, like, good newsstand distribution or whatever. It was, for me, it was like I had to kind of find out retro how it all happened or whatever. But I thought that made sense. Mm. You know, to streamline it and all that kind of stuff. Because after a while, I mean, you just use up so much energy just walking.
Well, it's unusual they went with a gray color, because they had concerns about the Hulk being gray and showing how that would translate onto the color-wise onto the comic page. And that was the idea of why they would look to turn him green.
Well, that's really funny. And it's like nobody ever stays the same color at Marvel for very long. Is that it?
Yeah.
I recall that, and it kind of, like I said, it made sense. I just went back recently because I wrote the intro to the Marvel Coffee Table book for the old Tales of Suspense.
Sure.
And I had to actually sit down and read all those really early issues, and they were some pretty funny stuff. I mean, Iron Man charged himself up with 2 D-cell batteries at one point. You know, it's like, come on, that could, like one leg would move. Oh, I need another battery. You know, it's like it was pretty funny.
So the thing that Mike and Bob are doing right now, they're doing a little sketch, and they are going to, as you all got tickets for, they're going to be giving away to 2 lucky winners at the time. What are you guys drawing in this Men of Iron panel, coincidentally?
I think we're both going for the same thing, which is basically Iron Man.
Yeah, Iron Man panel.
Otherwise,
drawing Iron
what
Man.
Would be the point?
We've exactly.
Got hands
so,
up in the back.
There we go, some hands. So we're okay with the Iron Man characters, then, yeah. I guess we'll be that. How do you guys have seen, I don't know how much of the movie that you've seen or how many previews or images, how do you think the armor and the effects have translated into what you've seen so far?
I thought it looked pretty cool.
Oh, it looks great. Yeah. I mean, if they've got a good story to go with it, it's going to be an amazing movie.
That's all I care about. You?
Yeah,
I mean, even if it didn't look great, I mean, it was a great story. I mean, here's my argument about movies today, which gets to a whole different subject, but you know this because we've talked about it. I'm a big fan of 50s science fiction movies, you know, and one of the reasons why is they didn't have big special effects, so they had to rely on 2 elements. They had to rely on character and storytelling.
Right.
You know, and to me, that's like the most important thing. I mean, who cares if the armor doesn't look like it looks in the comics or whether, you know, a moment of clunky, whatever. If it's an engaging story, you're going to forgive it in a heartbeat, right? Because you want to see our Iron Man on the screen. So, to me, anytime you deal with movies, I think you have to be true to the spirit of what that character is about. And as long as they're true to the spirit of it, they can change all the tchotchkes and whatever they want. You know, it doesn't really matter.
Is that semi-generational though, in the respect that a younger generation like my 8-year-old son Luke down here might have higher expectations of the visual effects than we might. I grew up on Doctor Who, so when the walls moved a bit, or the Dalek, the pepper pot of the Dalek, you know, it looked like it was coming apart a bit. As long as Bob was saying, there was an engaging story, I didn't care too much. But younger generations might have a bit of a concern.
They might have for the visuals, yeah. But again, if it's a strong story, it's not going to matter if they're good or bad, really. Yeah. I hope.
So, question for Bob and Dave. You are now back with a couple Iron Man projects. One is Legacy of Doom, which I believe is a 4-issue miniseries, and another one is The End, which is a 48-pager?
Yes.
One-shot 48-pager?
Yeah, okay.
Can you give us a brief overview of both and, you know, your parts in it? And
I'm the inker.
Go ahead.
You're the co-plotter, Bob.
Right.
That comes first.
Well, there's long stories.
You want to take one, or I'll take the other?
No, actually, because, you know, if you're going to talk about the story, you should talk about it, to the most part. I'll chime in, you know, but because I got to draw. But also, the fact that both of those have a kind of a little bit of a long history, because neither one of those projects was something we walked in the door, like, you know,
been
6 months ago
for a while,
and said, hey, here we go, how about this? You know, so I'll take it away, Dave.
Well, we were approached by Marvel, gosh, 2000 was it?
Yeah.
About 2000 to do Iron Man The End, and we turned in a plot which we thought was, well, they told us they wanted our Iron Man, how we would handle the character and the story if we'd been handling the plots all this time and this was the last story, how we would handle it. And we did that, and they said, well, that's not exactly what we want.
Well, so who approached you? Who is this? Who's the first initial contact?
They contacted Bob.
Who contacted you, Bob?
I forget the editor's name.
For the first time or the second
end.
Time?
First time, the end.
First time. Yeah. I don't remember the guy's name.
Tom
it was Tom Brevoort's assistant.
Okay.
And I can't remember his name. Mark's...
No, I'm not going to get it.
Sumerak.
Okay. Sprung a leak.
Excellent. We'll go with that.
Wow. How about that?
No one will know the difference.
I just like talking like that. No. It was. Mark Sumerak was his assistant. Is the guy who talked to us initially about that. But you know, see, because what they were upset about was the fact that Dave and I see Tony Stark as a winner, as a guy that no matter what happens, no matter what kind of crap you throw him into, that he finds some way to get out of it. He finds some way to in the end achieve his goals. So in the last Iron Man story, we had him walk away a winner. They're like, no, you got to turn him into a crippled cyborg, and he's got to like blow his brains out or something. And we're like, no, we don't do that. That's not the way we see. You said the way we see the character, right? And it's just like we talked it over, and we're just like, we don't want to do that story.
No, we gave him an alternate plot, and they never even responded to it. So it just kind of died. And then about a year ago, they contacted Bob to offer him the inking assignment on the regular Iron Man book. And he was thinking about that. And then they got a new penciler. And I think the penciler was inking himself or something
like that. So, I was always big.
Yeah, so they to make up for that loss of work, they asked, were there any other projects you want to do? And he said, oh, we happen to have a couple right here. So we resurrected The End as one of those projects. And we did it pretty much our way. We changed some things to meet their requirements in a way that may met our own requirements as well. So it's our story, it's one we want to tell, slightly modified.
And the Legacy of Doom, give us a quick 100 words or less on the plot of that, because I know that touches back into something, into areas that you had delved into before in the earlier series.
100 words?
100 words or less.
Oh, he's going to count.
You
I
bet.
Warn you, you don't know David, he'll count.
I have to take off my shoes to get to 20.
Okay. Well, we don't get to 21, that's all I care about. As long as we're good.
Oh, that's good.
Very good.
I mean, let's hope we'd get to 21. I mean, I'm saying, you
know, I like that.
Moving forward.
Okay, anyway, Legacy of Doom is the third part of a three-part trilogy, which makes sense. we did a story, time travel story with Dr. Doom on our first run on the book when we... got back on the book some years later. We thought it would be nice to do a sequel. And then when we did the sequel, it just felt right to do a trilogy, but then we were off the book. We had, when we did a miniseries called Bad Blood, about 2000-2001, the editor asked if there were any other projects we wanted to do. We said, why don't we do a third part to the trilogy? And she said, okay, and we sent a plot in, and then the editor went away, and we never heard from anything about it. So that was another one of the projects that Bob offered them after they, you know, the mix-up with the inking job.
So what's new to the? Because I remember reading that back issue interview that you guys did, the pro-to-pro interview, and you talked about, you know, bringing newness to the character every time. What's new this time around to the equation that you put in there?
Oh, okay. There are new things both with Iron Man and Dr. Doom. The visual newness, there is a new mystical armor for Iron Man that appears at the end of issue 3. Dr. Doom's armor also, maybe for the first time, I don't know his... If you do research, maybe you guys will know more about the history. Dr. Doom's armor changes during this for a while also. So we've got two new visuals. As far as the Tony Stark aspect, we have him confronting one of his greatest weaknesses, which is his refusal to accept, if not believe, accept that magic exists. He's always been very, very uncomfortable about anything supernatural. His world is that of technology, real world, what you can touch, what you can feel, what you can prove. And the fate of a great many lives depends on him altering his viewpoint. That's new to him.
Yeah, we really kind of like, because we always worked in that comfort zone of him being a technologically based hero, and we dealt with like corporate intrigue and, you know, high tech menaces and stuff. This story is pretty much like Tony Stark being like molested by World of Warcraft. I mean, it's
worse than my visual from a minute or two ago.
It was really kind of what we wanted to go with it, in a sense of, because we didn't want to do the same thing we always did. We really wanted to take it someplace else. And of course, the other thing we didn't mention, which we should, is the visual aspect is Ron Lim. You know, because
did he change his armor too?
Yeah, Ron Lim's got a new armor, but Ron is somebody that Dave and I worked with on Future Comics on Metallics, and I he was one of those guys that I always thought should pencil Iron Man. I mean, he's got the dynamics, and he was one of the biggest fans of our work on the series or whatever. So when we had a chance to do this, you know, I contacted Ron about coming on board as our penciler. And, you know, it's one of those things where he's just like a dream to work with. I mean, he makes deadlines. He tells a story like nobody else. And he's the nicest guy in the world. I call him up and say, Ron, there's a real big problem with this armor, on this mystical armor, and I think you have to change it. He's like, I can't wait to change it. That is so great. I cannot wait to change it. It's so much fun. Listen, I'll do it. I'll do you 50 sketches, and you pick out from the 50, and I'll have them to you tomorrow. I mean, he's like that. And he's like, he's the most high-energy guy in the world. You know,
it's the second most high energy guy in the world.
No, because I'm doing an impression, okay?
I want to see Mike's drawing after Bob and Dave are like thumping on the table as Mike goes along.
That's
here.
More excuse, okay?
Okay, there we go. We're built in.
Would have been a lot better except for that.
Except for the thing.
So I have a question. Sorry, go ahead, Bob.
No. So that's. I just want to get a Ron Lim plug in there because he did an incredible job on the, and. I know we're both thrilled to work with him anytime.
Absolutely.
And as far as I'm concerned, he can pretty much pencil anything we do.
Great. So a question for you, Mike.
Sure.
Bob and Dave said that, hopefully I'm getting this accurate, that back in 78, they pretty much had free reign with Iron Man at the time from an editorial perspective.
Yeah.
Again, it wasn't a high-selling book at the time, and as always with the case, you know, they'll give you more freedom if there's nothing really at stake. When you were writing the book in 2003, 2004, what type of editorial forces did you encounter during that time? Sort of what you wanted to bring, perhaps versus demands of what they had an interest in seeing?
It started out as a very good cooperative editorial relationship. We would discuss the direction we wanted to go with the character. I saw Iron Man as... at the time, I thought that we had gotten away from the man and things had been a little bit too much oriented toward the armor. Everything was very high-tech, and it was as if once he puts on the armor, he's completely sealed away from everything else, and it becomes something other than Tony Stark, and it seemed to me like it was better to go back to the aspect of showing the man inside the iron. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to make the stories a bit more human, focus on the relationships and things like that to begin with. I see Tony Stark as this guy who's not only protected by his armor, but his armor also seals him off mm-hmm. from the rest of the world. And that's, from a strictly human standpoint, that's a rough thing to deal with. So I made the character as human as possible, tried to stress the relationships of the supporting cast and things like that. I revealed a secret identity for which I don't know if they ever explained that away, like woke up and there was Bobby Ewing in the shower or something like that.
I think they just did that with Spider-Man, didn't they? Bobby Ewing just woke up in the shower with Peter Parker and Mary Jane's history was erased.
I think so.
But sounding a little gay, isn't it?
A little.
I don't doubt it for a second. It was an avenue that I wanted to pursue, and I had the support and cooperation of the editorial staff at the moment, and then as things went further and further along, we began to sort of fall apart in terms of communication. There were changes made to some of my stories without even notifying me. No. Which was not a really good way to go in the long run.
Were these fundamental things, like somebody took it on a 180,
there were aspects that were rewritten by someone else after I had turned in the story, and what bugged me was that it was without consulting me, without even telling me that there was a problem, or they felt that there was a problem that needed to be changed, or something like that. I'm a pro, you know. Mm-hmm. If I send in a story and somebody calls me up, an editor says, "We got a problem with this. We think it needs to be reworked. I'll rework it." That's not a problem.
Sure.
But it's irritating when you pick up the book when it's in print and go, "Wait a minute! They changed that whole segment of action."
It's not just irritating; it's insulting.
It's totally insulting.
That's a good word for it.
Yeah, I had that done to me recently with another publisher. But the point is, that's something you guys understand. For us, who really try to put 100% into what we do, the biggest problem with that is you guys don't know when they make those changes.
Yeah, absolutely.
You pick up the books and you read them thinking that that's our intent. And for us as creators, it's incredibly frustrating, especially when the changes they make don't necessarily improve the story. It's happens to do with the editor's personal peccadilloes, and that's tough. But it's so funny what you mentioned about Iron Man too. Getting back to that for a second, in terms of you reapproaching the character of Tony Stark, which is what we did. I mean, when we took over Iron Man, it was like we felt like it was all about the guy in the suit. I mean, about the suit, not about the guy.
Yeah,
and that's our direction. Because in the industry, there's a funny thing about that. There's this sort of like entropy that happens. I mean, think about it. How many times has Superman been revised and updated, and then sooner or later, Crypto shows up. You know? I mean, because DC can't get out of that mindset. And sooner or later, no matter what they do to revamp Superman, Crypto and Super Monkey are going to show up someplace, you know? Because they just had a mindset, you know? I mean, how many times do they get rid of Supergirl, but here comes Supergirl again, which I don't mind the miniskirts. But, you know, at the same time, it's that same thing. You know, for some reason, you find that there's this kind of thing that creeps into certain characters where they lose track of what it's about, or they have this kind of history that they try to kind of force it back into what it originally was, or into this pigeonhole in a way, you know. And every so often, it's just like what Thomas Jefferson said, every so often you have to rebel.
I was going to ask the question about editors in the 80s versus editors now, although from what Mike has just mentioned, how much growth has there been really in terms of, if that's the level of communication that exists?
This was my specific instance.
Yeah,
that's all.
I think it's also it depends on the editor. If the editor editors have different levels of conscientiousness and so forth then and now.
Yeah. Also, keep in mind that we're all working in the business right now. So if we start going on a tirade about editors, it's really
what
kind
do we
of
get fired?
You know. But let me say that part of our problem for the let's say the mature crowd.
Yeah.
In comics, is that we were spoiled. We worked for guys like Archie Goodwin and
Joe Orlando
or Denny O'Neill. Guys who really knew what they were doing. I mean, these are guys who have like resumes as long as your arm, and some of the best writers who were ever in the history of comics.
The guys who had read something other than comic books.
Yeah, who brought something to the game. They were real editors, and those kind of folks don't really exist in this business to a large degree. There are some, But so the whole definition of what an editor is and what they do now is a little different than it was in let's say the Silver Age of comics.
Well, you were effectively an artist at one point, and then you were also an editor, if not editor in chief, at Valiant.
Yeah, I totally sold out.
You sold out. No, what difference is there? How did you have to in dealing with talent? Because you were now in the shoes of that individual who was dealing with talent,
right?
How did you see your mindset change during that time, or did it?
It didn't really change that much, because to me, you know, it's like this is what they should do. The guys on the other side of the desk, you know, in management or whatever, should be cognizant of what the artists are there for, what they're trying to accomplish, what they need, both in a financial sense and a creative sense. Now, you don't always accomplish that because, you know, you're dealing with, you know, a large company with a lot of different creators, and everybody, you know, has their little quirks and stuff too. But, you know, you think of Valiant, are we really trying to revolutionize things and show some respect to the creators? I mean, there was the only company that ever gave royalties to colorists because we actually consider coloring art.
Yeah,
you know, and it's like we you know, and it's like we tried to reward our creators nicely with a very good royalty system. You have to be cognizant. At the same time, you have two goals. You have to run the business, but you also have to manage the creative teams there and keep everybody happy. And at the same time, keep an overview of what's happening in the entire universe. So it was challenging, but I never lost the sensibility. It's like I'm one of them now, or something like that.
Was there a moment though where you had to step in and be that type of?
Oh yeah, there's always been
be the editor and put that.
Yeah, because at the same time, I mean, come on, we're all a bunch of guys who work at home, live pretty much in a vacuum, you know, other than the guys who work there in the office in Knob Row. But yeah, we work in a vacuum, so we don't really have an overview. Most of the creators don't have an overview of what the whole business side of it is. I mean, that's one of the reasons I got into it, was I really, really wanted to learn every aspect of the business I chose to work in. And so yeah, it's challenging, but sometimes it's hard to impart what the macro view is to individual creators. But I think we were very good, for the most part, at communicating. I mean, as we got bigger, the trouble is the bigger the entity becomes, the less control, the less you have over the product and the people involved in it. And that's one of the problems with any company, is it's just, you know, when it becomes huge like that, no one person can really manage all of it.
But everything that I've heard, everything I've talked about, communication is the key, and if you don't have that, the breakdowns happen.
12 books is the maximum. If you ever start your own comic book company, don't put out more than 12 titles. All right. That's just my advice.
All right. That? Okay, good.
After 12 titles, you lose control.
Yeah.
All right. The end.
Okay.
And thank you for coming.
So, all three of you have talked about your desire, your time on the Iron Man book as bringing back, getting into the, you know, emphasizing the humanity of the character and bringing that into play more than, per se, the armor. As everyone I'm sure out there knows, one of Bob and Dave's first stories was introducing the notion of alcoholism into the Tony Stark character when they first came on board. I'm going to give you a quote. I'm going to read you guys a quote. This is a quote from Steve Ditko.
Okay.
And
I know which one it is.
He's taking an opposing idea to that, and I wanted to get your commentary on that. He said that my independent material contrast with opposing challenged the dominating and growing comic book anti-hero premise at both Marvel and DC, where that anti-hero premise grew into Marvel's drunken Iron Man and the DC's death of Superman. Those who accept a hero as a drunk or disposable could hardly accept the premise of a true hero, of a man at his best, a rational, moral best. Dave, what's your opinion on that?
I differ.
Okay. How so?
Because facing your own personal demons, your own weaknesses, and everybody's got them. Steve's got them. And if he faces them and conquers them and triumphs over them, that makes him heroic. No matter what he could, you know, do funny things with German shepherds and, you know, with the door closed. And okay, if he faces that and he conquers it, that's heroic. He may still have these negative traits. He's still a hero, not necessarily an anti-hero. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tony Stark isn't an anti-hero. He's heroic because he does what's right, both in the world and eventually with what's right for himself. That, to me, makes him even more of a hero.
Yeah, in that philosophy, Mother Teresa is a villain to Steve Ditko because she questioned her faith. Mm-hmm. You know, so that makes, you know, I mean, which means we could have her in Iron Man. She's a villain now.
I wrote her biography.
Well, we could do her as a Ditko villain, which means she'd attack him like this.
There's a huge difference in dimensionality when you're talking about the old school heroes. When you go back to the heroes of the 1950s and the early 1960s, Spider-Man was a whole different ball of wax. Probably the first character who had bags of human foibles and problems, but they weren't perceived as weaknesses. They were just perceived as making him a little bit more like your average Joe on the street. Well, that average Joe on the street aspect doesn't stop when it comes to normal challenges that people face. The world is full of alcoholics. The world is full of people with drug problems. The world is full of people who go home and kick their dog or their kid through a hedge, right? People can relate, I think, on many levels to a character who has this problem, who has a challenge that he has to face, and work on it and overcome it. It's not something that just ends. It doesn't go away. It's always with you. If you have a drinking problem, you're going to have a drinking problem. It doesn't matter if you didn't have a drink today. You still have a drinking problem. If you didn't have one for the last year, you still have a drinking problem.
But yeah, the idea of tying that into morality is to me ludicrous.
It has nothing to do with morality whatsoever. Nothing to do with morality. The greatest heroes that I can think of all had something that added to them that made them that much more human, and I saw that as one of the key aspects with the Tony Stark character. It made him that much more human, more likable, because he had not just the frailty of this heart that's being kept alive by the machine that he wears, but he has something that you can relate to in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Can I just make one other comment?
Sure.
History has proven Steve wrong.
Yeah. What about Iron Man these days? Has taken on a different tact in terms of being considered almost the villain of the Marvel Universe, and in terms of revisionist history. We've talked a lot about, up here, revisionist history and people changing characters and flipping them on their legs.
Isn't he a Skrull?
We never know. Who knows?
Is he a Skrull?
I could be a Skrull, apparently.
I think he should be a Skrull. It just makes it lots of fun. I don't know. I'm a seller, not a buyer. I don't read the current Iron Man. So, you know, I mean, you guys know what we think Iron Man should be. We did it. All right. If it's not that, then you know, our answer would probably be predictable.
Is that why you couldn't be on the Iron Man title, the regular monthly title today? Do you think? Because there seems to be such a tight editorial control, almost to where they get together in those editorial conferences at a particular point in the year and sort of plan out the whole year for the company, and then everybody's stories or books almost have to fall in line to that. Like, we're going to have the Secret Invasion this year or Civil War this year, and if I'm a creator and I want to bring something new to the book and it challenges that plan, you know, how can I do that? So I would divert off to a separate project like you individuals have.
Bob could probably speak to that from his experience with Valiant, but I think the more intricately involved the continuity becomes with the other books in the lineup, the more important it is for the company to make sure that everybody's on the same page. You can argue the point one way or the other, whether it's good or whether it's bad. I think it's more out of necessity than anything else. If you gave writers free rein, which I actually enjoyed quite a bit while I was over at DC, I ignored everybody else's continuity and just wrote what I wanted to write and double take the hindmost. Julie Schwartz used to say, there's Earth 1, Earth 2, and Earth Grell. And that's how I avoided having to put the Warlord into the DC universe, despite
efforts to the contrary by just about everybody that I worked with, and everybody who came after that. You know, after I left the book, the first thing they did was they brought in the Power Girl and a bunch of other people, all the superheroes.
You know, they were going to team them up with Crypto sooner or later, right?
Apparently so. As a matter of fact, I'm working on a special 35th anniversary story that is now going to feature Crypto.
I hope so. Man, you can't. I can't get enough super dogs.
Really? We're talking gorillas. Yeah. Talking gorillas are good too.
Oh yeah, that was definitely an era.
So, Dave, as a writer, could you exist in this type of era where the crossover, the event of the year, drives almost the entire, certainly the editorial side, but the creative side as well? Would you want to exist in that?
Oh, what I want? That's different. Could I, or do I want to? Those are two different questions. Could I? Sure. I'm a professional writer. I know how to do my job, and I'll do it, or I'll do it the way I'm supposed to do it, the way they want to do it, or I won't do it at all. I'll turn the assignment down. Would I like it? It's. I wrote Action Comics for about 3 years, and I was 1/5 of a writer because there were 5 books, 4 weeklies, and a quarterly. So it came out 52 times a year. And it was very difficult because I'd be left all kinds of like cliffhangers that I'd have to solve, and then in my books and other people, it's very, very difficult, even just within 5 titles of a Superman book. So to something that's interesting, why it would be difficult, it would not be my first choice. Someone offers me a job, I'll take it.
Yeah, I mean, we're professionals. I mean, pretty much, like, okay, you take it like a challenge. We'll do it. You know, sure. You know, we'll do your dumb story. You know, we'll try to figure out some way to make it undumb in the process. I mean, we've undumbed a lot of stuff over our years. And, you know, but, I mean, it happens. I mean, it's like because, you know, there's basically part of being a professional comic book person is that there's a little bit of prostitute in all of us. And, you know, we like to make a living. We like to earn our money and do something. We would prefer to do stuff like Iron Man The End or Legacy of Doom, where it's something we would probably do for free under the right circumstances. But, yeah, as professionals, you just kind of look at it and say, okay, do I want to do this? No. But do I should do it. I need the money. It's like I can do the best possible job under the circumstances, even if it is the dumbest ass thing I've ever read in my life.
And people talk now like event books have just started, but there, I mean, Secret Wars was, if not the first, I mean, they were back in the 80s, or sure, in the 80s as well. Sure. Do you remember the oncoming event of that, that sort of philosophy, and how you so all of a sudden had to sort of streamline? They might say, this book has to feature this because it's going to cross over into here, and you have to tailor your writing to that.
I remember when it started, but fortunately, most of the books that I was involved in weren't involved with the big, I mean, like Iron Man, when we started, it wasn't one of the big books at Marvel, so it was kind of left off. But I remember some things, events, they had 1 year in the annuals, Superman, DC, was it DC or was it Marvel? It's Marvel.
Well, you did Atlantis Attacks. I didn't do that one, remember?
I probably did because I thought I could come up with a good story. But 1 year they had everybody, if you did the annual, you had to create a new character. And which, of course, then Marvel would then own, you know. And that was it. So I declined to do the annual that year. So you've always got a choice. You can say no. But,
that gets me into
DC had that policy. They had a lineup of books that they did, and they mandated that everybody had to create a new character. And oh, by the way, it was work for hire, and DC owned the character.
Why not donate a kidney while you're at it? You know?
Yeah. Being a professional prostitute, I did. But in the process of doing it, I accidentally created a good one, and I had already sent in the outline for the story, and as soon as it went in, I went, "Oh crap, that's a good character!" So I got on the phone with the editor. And I unsold it.
You convinced him it wasn't any good?
I convinced him it wasn't any good.
That's great.
The character that I created was this, the one that showed up in print was this war veteran who had a prosthetic hand, or excuse me, had a prosthesis, and when he would activate his power, his hook would become this giant hook claw thing. It could cut through anything. And by the time I was done, the editor is going, "Yeah, that's great, that's great." I was close. That was close.
So now we're in a bit of a different era where, and Mike, this is especially applicable to you, where you can put your work up online and have literally complete control. It's not even a question of having to find a publisher anymore, like First Comics, like you did for Sable back in the day. You literally now have, you know, your artwork, Sable artwork, up online. Can you talk to why you decided to go with that?
It was something that my old editor pal, Mike Gold, and I had been discussing for about, I don't know, since the infancy of the internet. Back in those days, the problem was that there was no high-speed internet, and downloading a file that ran even just a couple of megs took an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. You could maybe put up a page a day, but you know, somebody had to really be seriously interested in it in order to spend all the time that it took to wait for the page to download, or you could click on it and walk away from your computer forever and come back eventually and there would be an image for you to take a look at. Finally, technology caught up with the concept, and Gold caught up with a fellow who had a lot of money to spend, and they created Comic Mix. So I'm actually working for a publisher in the sense that Comic Mix is the publisher, and ultimately the books will be available in bookstores. The reason that they're up on the internet right now is because of advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, you make a certain amount of money as you go, and it also makes this great promotional tool so that eventually when the story is finished next week, I have 5 more pages to go, it will be printed and distributed in the bookstores, and people will be able to go there and buy the whole collection. And, of course, the first thing that people want to ask is, well, what's to prevent them from just printing it out at home? Maybe check the cost of printer ink. The printer ink for a 132-page graphic novel like Sable, which is, you know, some high-intensity color and everything else. I think my antique Epson printer uses about $130 worth of ink to print 132 pages of full color. It's just not practical to do that. You can if you want. By all means, be my guest. Bring it to me, I'll sign it.
Well, you know, somebody will.
I'm sure there are people that already have. And they'll be showing up, you know, at the very next convention to have it signed. No problem. God bless them. But I think it opens up an amazing avenue for the future, because face it, the world is changing around us so fast. I use a computer now, right? I mean, I know guys, Harlan Ellison still has a closet full of manual typewriters. One that he works with, and all the rest are for spare parts.
Yeah.
Because, right, it's just that way. If I can learn to use a computer, then I guess anybody can learn to handle the technology, but you sort of have to learn to do that stuff.
Well,
you get left behind.
Don't leave out the audience either. The fulfillment system is far less complicated.
Yeah.
Because I have my own webcomic I've been running for years.
Yep.
And, you know, my site gets about 600,000 individual hits a month, which... how many people are reading X-Men? How many copies of X-Men sell a month?
Yeah.
All right. So I have 5 times the readership than the X-Men has.
Yeah.
So that's the other great thing about the internet.
Yeah.
And Dave, it was interesting that Mike talked about having to unsell a particular idea. Mm-hmm. The idea being that, you know, creative people don't want to give up their ideas. Do you see the internet, as an avenue for you to take your ideas and keep your ideas and see yourself branching more into that type of area? And staying with a traditional publisher, or you know, whatever the ratio mix is, you see that ratio increasing for yourself? And
well, for me, I've always been leery of putting anything on the net, because then someone could just take it and do whatever they want with it. I'm not all that certain about the copyright laws and having to, and even if it is copyrighted and so forth, if someone takes it and uses it and puts their name on it, then you got to hire a lawyer, and it's just so easy to take things off the internet. So I'm not looking in that direction, but then again, I'm something of a Luddite with computers anyway, so... I don't know what the future.
That's what he has me for, though.
Okay. That's true.
I'm trying to inject him into the 21st century.
Kicking and screaming.
Here we go. One final round here, and then I want to open the floor up for some questions. I wanted to end it on a sort of people note, because I know these four people that I'm about to name, you've all worked with, and I'd like to get your impressions. Some quick impressions of these individuals.
Do we have to do impressions of them?
Well, you can.
You don't even have
to. You
know,
like, you can if you want. I'd love to see your impression of the first person I'm going to name, Paul Levitz. You've all worked with Paul at various stages of his career. He's now the head honcho of DC Comics, if you will, but he started off as a writer working. What are your
He was assistant editor on my first stories. He was assistant editor with Joe Orlando. Solid professional, honest, one of the few people who treat you right. You can depend on it. That's my experience.
I go back further than anybody with Paul, because when I used to put out CPL, Paul put out almost like the sister magazine to it called Etc.
Sure.
It was like the Midwestern gang and then the New York Brooklyn gang.
How the hell old are you?
I have a portrait of me at home that is hideous. I was incredibly young when I started, though. See, that's a different thing. Don't realize that. He and I both were like 19 years old when we broke into comics.
Yeah.
But so my association goes back to Paul to his fan days. And then when I started working in DC, he was my first writer I worked with there on All-Star Comics when I took over the inking that with Wally Wood. So I've always had a great association. Paul is great because every so often, to this day, I totally echo what Dave was saying, because I'll go out to my P.O. box or something, and there's this big like crate from D.C. in there, and I'll pull it out, and it's some toy related to something I did. You know, it's like bookends with the Huntress or something kind of thing like that. And Paul will just send them to me, you know. He'll take the time out and send me, like, gratis copies, which nobody does. I mean, Marvel put out the statues of Iron Man, so I never got one of those, you know. But he will actually take that time and with a hand note on it, you know. And this is the president of DC Comics, so, I mean, that's what else you got to say. I mean, he's really one of the great guys in the business.
I actually drew Paul's first story.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was it Legion?
Legion of Superheroes.
I think I remember that.
And we worked together for a lot of years, had a great relationship. We co-created a character for the Legion called Dawnstar. I had the costume, I had the name, I couldn't figure out what the heck she was supposed to do. I had nothing for the character, it was just graphics and a name. And Paul came up with all the rest of it. I thought he was a very astute businessman, surprisingly creative for a business-oriented guy, and I like that. I like the fact that after all these years, every now and then my mailbox opens up and there's a check.
Those are better than the toys.
Well, I don't know. You can play with a toy for a while. You know, the check after a while.
The price of some of these toys I've seen out here, they might be bigger than some of the checks. That's
no doubt.
Dave, how about Dick Giordano? Because I know you and Bob have certainly.
I know Dick. Bob is, you know, good buddies with him. Dick again. He's one of the best inkers, and he's a. You know, he's a nice, fun guy to be around. I don't really know him that well. He's done some inking on some of the books I've done.
Dicky, you know, is one of my mentors. So, you know, we're still very, very close friends. I live in, like, you know, South Florida, and, you know, Dicky lives on the East Coast in, like, Retirement Central or whatever there, and I kind of live over on the West Coast in like, Hurricane Alley. But since we've been down there for about 10 years, and so every first Wednesday of the month, we meet in Orlando and just have lunch and chat, whatever. Because he's also stone deaf, so it's the only way I can talk to him. You know, until recently, we actually got two-way like video communication on the internet, so he could actually read my lips and stuff because he doesn't hear too well anymore. But he was our director at Future Comics as well. But when I started out in comics, when I moved to East to break in or whatever, and I was doing a lot of assisting work, I mean, Dickie kind of took me under his wing there at Continuity and just kind of, like, taught me something. He was my hero. You know, I was there, and I was like, you know, I didn't care about Neil Adams. I wanted to learn everything from Dick, you know. And so even, like, when I was running Valiant and he was running DC, we would meet for lunch in Midtown somewhere, you know, and just, like, talk. You know, so we've been friends for as long as Dave and I have been friends, you know, a little longer actually, about 34 years or whatever. So yeah, don't say I'm really old, I know.
Yeah.
But we still maintain close. Dick is still working with me. You know, we did some projects together, DC, and he's the penciler on Colony, my webcomic.
Very nice. So one last person before
wait
we go
a
down.
Minute.
You got a good story? Okay.
Dick Giordano. Oh, yeah. I always admired Dick's work. He and Neil and their work on Green Lantern, Green Arrow set the tone for me. I always thought that Dick was, in my opinion, the best anchor in comics because he could interpret anybody's line and make it work. There was no question about spatial dimensionality, the thick and thin, the flexibility of his line. Just amazing stuff to look at.
He brought that ad art style to comics.
Yeah, he did. And I have Dick Giordano to thank for some of the outrageous crap I got away with when I was doing Green Arrow, because Dan Jurgens always wanted to push the envelope. Mike Gold just loves to get a stick and poke a hornet's nest, and the surest way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't. So we did some stories that really stretched things a lot. I mean, there was a good deal of nudity. There was some extreme violence that was done in those stories, and when the question arose at the corporate level, how come we're doing these kind of stories, they would just point to the inker's name that just happened to be Dick Giordano and go, he's the boss, what are you going to do?
So we're going to go one more person here, then we'll open it for questions, and then we'll raffle off the two drawings we have here. One of the best things, I think, about going to, say, like the San Diego Comic Convention for me was the chance to put a face to the names of the professionals.
I win.
He wins.
You're raffling these things?
Oh, we're raffling.
I won, right?
And really, you talk about comics being a solitary experience, you know, in your homes, rarely get as much like the kind of connection you have here. And I'd like each of you, starting with Mike, to tell me your best Dave Stevens story. Because we lost Dave Stevens very recently. Incredibly talented individual. The Rocketeer would be his signature character. Could you give me your...
My best Dave Stevens story.
Yeah.
The Rocketeer debuted as a backup feature in my Star Slayer comic book. Quickly overshadowed and totally eclipsed Star Slayer, and for damn good reason. It was an amazing achievement. It was incredible. Dave loved the stuff that he worked on. He had a passion for it that I haven't seen in anybody else. And I'm pretty passionate about what I do. I was in Boise, Idaho, doing a store show appearance, and a young lady, by young I mean 9 or 10 years old, comes up with a copy of Star Slayer, asks me to sign it, and she opens up the book in the back to the Rocketeer story. She said, do you know Dave Stevens? And I said, yes, I do. And she said, what's he like? And I said, well, he's way too tall, he's way too good looking, he's way too talented, and best of all, he's the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. And she said, oh good, because he's my big brother. Yeah, and the thing is, I wasn't lying at all. Dave was just an immensely talented, but a very, very nice and rather humble guy, considering the level of his talent. I don't think he had a clue how great he was.
I only met him once. I don't really have a story. It was a nice guy. Good handshake.
I never met him at all, so I don't have a story.
So that was a question for Mike, actually.
That's a good story. We're going to open the questions up, open the floor up to questions now. If everybody could ask questions, if you could stand up, raise your voice so everybody else could hear it, that would be great. Any questions for Dave, Bob, or Mike?
For future writers in the comic book business, how much pull you have with your editor? Like, how much can you say, no, I don't want this, and how much can you back it up and say, yes, this is my story and I want to stick to it?
If you have a good editor, If you have a good editor, you should have a good creative, cooperative, working relationship based on mutual respect. If your editor respects you and you respect him, you should be willing as a professional to listen to his arguments when he says, this doesn't work and here's the reason why. He should be able to tell you why it doesn't work. And he should be able to help you solve the problem.
Now tell him the reality.
The reality is, basically, what you want is a guy who can spell, punctuate, and knows when to stay the hell out of your road. That's pretty much it.
Dave?
What he said.
He's a writer, can you tell? The elaboration was...
Most of the time, you have to be prepared to argue your points. Because sometimes they don't know where you're going. Or they may not quite get it, or you may not have made it clear to them where you're going. So you have to be prepared to argue your points. But also, in the case of like Key and I on some projects, remember Cage? You have to be prepared to take your toys and go home.
Yeah, we unsold it.
We pulled a growl. We unsold it. You know, because we had a pitch. This was that was in the mid
90s.
After I got out of Valiant, right? 80s.
Sure,
was pre-Valiant, right?
Yeah.
And right after we finished our second run of Iron Man, we went and pitched a new Luke Cage premise. And I really loved that story, by the way, too.
Yeah.
It was fun. Because he was all fat and like lazy and stuff. And was acting as living as a bouncer. He was a down and out superhero. He was like an injured superhero. You know, he was like acting as a bouncer at a strip bar in Miami. You know, and he had totally lost his way. And Dave and I came up with this whole premise of him coming back. You know, finding his way back. You know, to honor and you know his, you know where he was, a comeback, a Rocky kind of thing. But of course, I think they wanted to give him a robot dog.
Crypto.
With a cake.
Crypto.
Wasn't it? They wanted a robot dog or something really ridiculous.
No, they
totally
wanted
a ridiculous idea. You know?
They wanted to change around because they were decided they were going to give Luke Cage his own new series. And what we had was a one-shot. And they thought that was good for a one-shot. But as a series, you need to have him do this, and he can't be that. And it just didn't work.
They wanted to take all the stuff that would have made it different.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Exactly. They
pretty much they wanted to blanderize it. So in that case, we unsold it.
Blanderize.
Yeah,
that's a great
with a trademark.
Yeah,
Steve Gerber. Yeah, speaking of another one that has passed.
Yeah.
Any other?
We're dropping like flies.
Well, that's terrible. Any other questions for the floor? In the back?
This is for all 5 minutes here.
Okay.
Yeah, you know how about like 5 minutes? About an hour ago, we all went, woo, when you said Iron Man, right?
Yeah.
Well, it just so happens that we go to Western Collegiate Institute. It's a high school, and our mascot happens to be Iron Man.
Really?
Really? We want to know, is that copyright infringement?
Security.
Nobody's there.
Is it just the name, or is it really totally like
blue Iron Man armor?
Yeah,
yeah. You're definitely. Well, I don't know. It's. I would get permission. I really would.
Marvel Comics.
If you're not making money from it,
down.
If you're not making money from it, it's kind of a novelty kind of thing that they might giggle and say, you know, this is really cute. Let's get some PR out of it. You know, and it's like if you're selling T-shirts and stuff like that, you're dead. They will come after you with a hammer.
The companies do this. Excuse me. They do this out of necessity. If they fail to actively protect their copyright, they can lose it. Okay, Disney will cheerfully sue anybody for millions of dollars to protect their copyrights. Paul Levitz had an interesting reputation a while back for suing everyone and anyone. He sued a college newspaper in Chicago that called themselves the Daily Planet, Daley, after Mayor Richard Daley, and he actually sued a comic book store that called itself the Bat Cave. That one, the federal judge threw it out of court after asking one question: do they sell comic books that you publish? And the answer was yes. And the judge went, case dismissed.
So my advice to you is change your mascot to John Sable.
Yeah, fine.
Or sell some comics that Marvel
sell
your
some
eyes.
We're gonna... you could be in some problems there.
On that litigious note, we're going to break into the raffles. Everybody have their tickets now? Do you want to hold up the two? Can we have, do you want to hold up the fabulous drawings?
That's, I like this Vanna.
The winner gets Bob's, the runner-up.
No, the first one gets, we'll go with this one. The first one is that one, and we're going to have Dave draw the tickets, if that's okay with you, Dave.
They'll blame you.
Yep.
You sure? They'll blame you.
Number.
There's a
number.
0197232.
232 at last.
Bingo.
Who's yelling bingo? Bingo. Bingo. Right there. Very good. The man in the back. Notice how I made the panel go just long enough for them to just finish their drawing there. That worked out.
That was great.
You're very good at your job.
Thank you very much.
Here you go, my friend.
Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
That's awesome.
And we go. Here we go for Mr. Grell.
Go on. Don't peek, Dave.
Which number was mine? Just the last three numbers?
Let's do the last four numbers. I don't think we're
four. 7205.
7205.
Bingo.
Bingo.
Bingo. That big O is from the guy who won it.
That was 0274. That was like having a.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you rarely get a treat like this where you get three of the most top professional and the nicest guys in the business coming to our city. So please say thank you to Dave, Mike, and Bob. And thank you all for coming.